This is the Paper Planes podcast, where we take a deep dive into some of the week's most notable business and marketing stories and interview high-performing business leaders and marketing professionals to find out their lessons for success.
But I think the interesting new dimension to all this is voice search. People are people. They just want to have natural communication. I think brands are going to have to take note of how they write copy and how that's interpreted by things, but also what the voice is of the brand, because that's actually going to be a thing. You know, you're going to have a voice.
Welcome to the Paper Planes podcast, episode number 66. And we have a gentleman on the show today that I am interviewing by the name of Mike Doyle. Now, he is the head of marketing for a retail brand called City Beach. Now, if you don't know who City Beach are because you're not in Australia, let me explain it like this, is that they are a millennial-focused company that sell a lot of things that you would use on the beach. And by that, I mean clothing mainly, but all sorts of other bits and pieces, but T-shirts, boardies, trainers, anything in that sort of surf, beach, skate kind of genre, fashion, stuff that I unfortunately had to stop wearing years ago because I got old. So if you want to freak out City Beach and you're 45 years old, then go and walk around their store because you're not their target market. But look, it is a legacy, I'm going to call it a legacy brand in Australia because it has been about a long time and it has a lot of history. And it's one that I think has adjusted particularly well to the changes in retail. It has kept very, very consistent with what it does, but still it manages to adapt and work with the target market particularly well. So look, Mike has a fantastic story and insight as to how City Beach have done that. He has a lot of background in a lot of other different areas. He's done a lot of marketing roles throughout Brisbane, Sydney, and he is a very entertaining and interesting man to listen to. And I think you'll get a lot out of it. So Mike Doyle is our guest today. Before we jump into that, the usual bits and pieces, rate and review us on iTunes, please. Follow us on Instagram. Gilberto, thepodcastboss.com, is our producer, our little Colombian friend who puts all this together for us every week. He is the go-to man for podcasts if you want to do a podcast. And lastly, as I mentioned last week, our new website is live, www.flypaperplanes.co. If you are looking for any help with your business marketing, your digital marketing, then come and talk to myself or Matt. Come to that website, find out what we do. You can talk to us through there, or you can come and find me on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook. Email me at simon@flypaperplanes.co. Send us a carrier pigeon. I don't know. Whatever you want to do, you know, we're flexible. We respond and reply in many, many different channels. So, look, that's that from me. Let us jump straight in and now hear what Mr. Mike Doyle has to say. So welcome to the show, Mike Doyle, who is the head of marketing for City Beach and also my very, very first Canadian on the show. So you have broken my Canadian virginity.
Listen, I'm happy to be here with you on this special occasion. You know, together we'll get through. It's exciting.
Now, just for the people that who are either old and have never shopped at City Beach or haven't shopped at City Beach recently, or for those that are listening in another country, which we do have quite a few, could you give us a bit of an understanding about who City Beach are and exactly what they do?
Yeah, for sure. Well, City Beach is an online and offline fashion retailer, primarily focused in the youth space. And that's not to say that there's not lots of old people that feel very comfortable shopping in our stores. I'm sure that some of our team would be, you know, cringing at the idea that someone over the age of 30 is walking in buying any of our clothes, but they certainly are. So youth fashion retail, and it's been around since 85, as I mentioned, and a mix of physical and online. So about 70 locations spread across Australia. And it's all based out of Brisbane, which
is exciting. Okay. Cool. Well, we're talking, I've got lots and lots of questions about City Beach and what you guys are doing there, but I just kind of want to get a bit of your background. So obviously we now know you're Canadian. How did you get to this? How the hell did you get here?
Well, as is always the way, it was a girl. I was the group sales coordinator up at a ski resort, so managing all the Olympic teams that are coming to train. And I used to ski quite a bit, but I broke both my knees, so I was somewhat less capable of as a skier. But when my employee, when I was in the HR department, he invited his family to come up to the ski resort, and the only person that wanted to ski was his sister. Everybody else wanted to snowboard. So I was anointed as the chief ski instructor for that fateful trip. And it was probably a few weeks later that we formalized our love for each other. And basically 3 months later, I married her. So moved here about 15 years ago to Australia.
Okay.
And haven't looked back. So yeah, had to find myself some employment, and that's where the journey began.
And you started off in Sydney, didn't you?
I did, yeah. So I was in Sydney for quite a while, sort of at a first off as the marketing manager for a telco, and then moved my way around and ended up in a couple of startups, and then moved up to Brisbane, or to the Gold Coast, actually, to work for Top Deck Travel, a part of the Flight Center Group now, and then on to Sydney Beach.
What got you into marketing originally? I can see you got a degree in communications and humanities, but you know, how did you, what set you off on that path?
I suppose the reality is that I always had a way with people. I interacted naturally with most people, and you know, I in my early days, my dad used to be the director of systems engineering for IBM, so he'd introduce me to all sorts of key sales executives, and I'd do all sorts of personality tests for the sales roles. As I was coming up as a young person, and I never actually did particularly well as a salesperson, but I was able to sell, which seems like a hugely, odd thing to be able to do without being, ranked as a proper salesperson. So I think the reality is that I was able to communicate with people, and I guess that kind of led into the communications role and then expanded out from there. So the combination of being, relatively logical and analytical, combined with the fact that marketing is kind of a communications spirit, that's where we ended up.
It's funny because I would probably say to you, 50% of the people I speak to on this podcast have got to where they've got to because they feel that they have a, not necessarily a talent, but maybe an inbuilt ability to sell. And whether that's selling themselves or selling a product, a lot of people have sort of gone, that's a really important part from a career perspective, to be able to sell something.
Yeah, I think being able to distill an idea. So, and one of the things I suppose is what a few of my team have coined my superpower is being able to listen and hear what people are saying, which I think, a lot of people think they're listening, but they're not actually paying attention. And I've listened to quite a few of your podcasts and a few others as well. And I think there's been a few times where people have said that, even in the spirit of the Dalai Lama of all people, most of the time what people are doing is forming an idea or a response to something as soon as you open your mouth.
Yeah.
As opposed to sitting back and relaxing into that and understanding what it is the person's trying to communicate. And communication is more than just words, strangely, as we sit here, digitally disconnected, or connected digitally, but not physically. I can't see your body language. I can't see if you're paying attention, but you get a sense of, that kind of stuff when you're in front of someone. And I think that's one of the interesting dimensions to marketing these days is that physical disconnection is really meaning that you need to work a lot harder in marketing to get back to what people do at their core, which is, read all of the signals in order for them to understand if they're doing a good job or not. And I guess the art is, the modern art of marketing is to be able to bridge what we used to do face-to-face to what we do now and make that feel natural.
One of the other, and it's interesting you talk about that communication, but obviously one of the things that you've done a lot of, and I would imagine still in your role, you still do at least oversee this, if not do it, but that's copywriting. Do you still do a lot of copywriting in your role?
I don't a lot. It's interesting because this organization doesn't necessarily think that copywriting is a specific thing. It's not necessarily divvied up in the way that you would think. And that's been the case for most of the places I've worked. It's kind of, there's a bunch of marketing people that are able to write basic copy. And then if it gets down to crunch time and we need to wordsmith something, that inevitably comes to me, my background in it. But I think, the words are Well, I think it depends on the audience you're speaking to as well, because I think that, you know, you can be a little bit more direct if the objective is sales, and I think you can be a little bit more illustrative with your language if it's not. And I think there's kind of a moment for all those things. And my talent tends to be in more prose than it is kind of headline copy, but I think, you know, horses for courses. But yeah, I do a little bit of that still, but I like to coach as opposed to do.
Yeah, and that's probably where I was going with this, because one of the struggles that, you know, I would have talking to a small business, a medium-sized business, is explaining to them why it's so important that copy on websites and copy in brochures and all those kind of things is done well. And I'm just interested in your insight as to what you would say, in front of somebody to explain to them the importance of getting that done properly.
Well, it's interesting because it kind of depends on, again, what you think properly is, because there's two schools of thought. One, you're writing copy for the bots. So you're writing SEO copy that caters for the things that are going to crawl your website to allow you to rank, or you're writing copy into your Amazon ad so that, you know, Amazon pops you up the top. And then there's a whole brand piece that comes through. And I don't know that there's a natural way of bridging those two things, but I think the interesting new dimension to all this is voice search. And I think that as natural communication kind of comes into what is a fairly blunt instrument, you know, obviously specific search terms will garner you results. But as the likes of Alexa and all that kind of stuff start to become more of a reality, especially more here in Australia, I think brands are going to have to take note of how they write copy and how that's interpreted by things, but also what the voices of the brand, because that's actually going to be a thing. You know, you're going to have to have a voice, you know, and that's an actual voice as opposed to, you know, written on the page. So it's an interesting cross-section of all those kind of schools of thought where, you know, you need to, you know, go from the years gone by where Mad Men style advertising agencies would put, you know, taglines to things and, you know, you'd have a persona in the room, to the kind of adolescent phase of the Google searching where you end up with copy that's written specifically to be crawled. And then you're kind of moving into the new era where maybe those two things need to be blended together. So it's an exciting time. I think it's, you know, it's taking some of the things that I took as sacrosanct when I was coming up, or, you know, that were super important when I was coming up in the early days of marketing, and blending that with the technology. So it's pretty amazing.
I want to go down that rabbit hole because it's funny enough, 2-3 days ago, we actually posted a blog about voice search, voice SEO, because it's obviously something that people are talking a lot about. Just looking at it from your specific marketplace, i.e. the youth, the fashion marketplace, do you think it's going to have a lot of impact? Because, and if you do, and again, it's how do you define what is a lot? Let me rephrase that question. What sort of impact do you think it will have in your marketplace? And I say that as someone that's still pretty much on the fence with whether we're going to actually start asking Alexa and Siri about, you know, where's the best place to buy a pair of trainers and all those kind of things.
Yeah. Well, I think that's, like your example is probably one of those things. I think that there's it's going to be a huge component of some vertical reality. So if you were to look at grocery or most of the spaces that Amazon plays well in, those are kind of replen style orders. So order me batteries. I don't really care what kind of batteries I get as long as they're the right size, you know, and loosely perform in the way that I would expect. Now there's another layer to that when you come into fashion, where it's, if I'm ordering the same pair of shoes that I've, you know, always ordered. So I'm a runner and I like, you know, pair A, and I run through them, and on my run I can say, geez, these things are really, you know, falling apart. You know, hey Alexa, order me another pair of the, you know, trainers that I love. And they come, that's great. And there's a convenience factor there, and you kind of give up a bit of control over, you know, your pricing and a whole bunch of other things for the convenience. And I think there's a lot of people that would happily give over a lot of control for that convenience. But I think there's an aspect, and it's kind of a hybrid for fashion, where depending on which side of this fence we fall, whether we fall on the side of the ultimate online showroom where everything is delivered to your home, you try it on, you put it back in the box and you send it back if you don't want it. Like, with that, model's never really taken off. And there's been a lot of startups that have pumped a lot of money into sending heaps of stuff to people that, you know, just have fallen over because the infrastructure's so expensive to facilitate it, it doesn't work as a model. So I think there's no doubt that there's going to be an aspect of this where fashion specifically is going to find a home. I think it'll be in the basics. And I think that there's going to be a certain aspect of, you know, maybe social shopping where you're able to combine things where you say, I see Kim Kardashian wearing that blue pair of shorts and I want it. I don't want to spend the time finding out what it is. I just want it in my size and I'll try it. But I think that that's a novelty. So I'm not sure that fashion's going to see that come along, but I think that people will search for things that are adjacent. So, you know, I might want to find a store, or I might want to find out what hours were open, or I might want to find out more about the brand or what we sell. In those kind of conversations that are either Google searches now, or, you know, awkward phone calls or staff interactions in store, can be harnessed and kind of moved into a different space. So I think that there's a place for it in all businesses, whether it becomes, you know, the next, you know, VR 360 camera of, you know, 2020. I'm not sure, but it should be interesting. I think you'd be silly not to take it seriously, even if it's, you know, you don't want to be the one guy saying, oh, this is going to be silly. And, you know, in 2 years' time, looking back at, you know, what could have been, there's no harm in dialing some of that stuff early.
I can see a space where you're asking Siri or you're asking Alexa, you know, what time is the city beach open to in Indooroopilly? Although, as I always point out to people, Siri and Alexa have no comprehension of the word Indooroopilly. So that's always a...
or Saskatchewan is a Canadian. Always a
exactly.
Try and say that five times fast.
That's one of the things I still kind of trying to get my head around is the complexity of place names. It's just a big struggle for these.
But I think the context in which you're searching is missing from the current iteration of all of these searches. Mm. So if you're able to preface a search with context, and that's something that people do naturally. So, you know, when you're speaking to a toddler, because I've got two little people, like sometimes that context is lacking, and when you speak to them, you say, hey, you know, what on earth are you talking about? Because you've kind of started midstream of consciousness here. You know, okay, well, what are we talking about? You kind of need to, you're the Alexa of that conversation. You're lacking that context. You can kind of jump in with some irrelevant stuff in the kids, so they don't really care. But I think the search world is the same way. So I think there's going to be a point at which either there's inferred context. So I am observing you as a searcher, and I know that you've been looking for something. And so I'm able to extrapolate that you're looking for a location, not Indooroopilly as address. So, I mean, I think they're making amazing advances. So I don't see that's going to be a huge problem. I think there'll be a conversation to be had with something that feels more natural. And then from that, you'll end up with some context, you know, contextual search is pretty much there from a typing perspective. So I think it won't be very long for it to be relevant on voice. I think it all feels a bit clunky at the moment, but I don't see that as something that's too hard to overcome.
I was going to say there's a long conversation we could go on here about artificial intelligence and all those kind of things, but
it's an exciting space.
We might save that for another day, because I kind of want to ask. I've got quite a few questions about City Beach, and that's where you've sort of been for the last over three years.
Yeah.
I guess my first question is how the brand stays fresh, because it is quite a long legacy brand. It's when did you say it was founded?
85. So yeah,
it was 80. So I mean, how many years? What's that?
Should know that off the top of my head.
30 years.
Exactly.
Yeah. 34 years.
Yeah, 34. 2019.
That's a long legacy, well established brand. You know, that we're not in startup territory there. How does it stay fresh? What has it done over the past few years to stay fresh in the marketplace and keep appealing to a very evolving demographic that itself is undergoing radical transformation?
Well, I think the key to that is that the DNA of the brand has always been that we need to be current. So I think that was the vision from day one. So the organization itself, you know, started in 1985. And I think the reality was that a lot of the products that got stocked in those early days were because there was a demand for it. So I think if we kind of go back to our conversation earlier where, you know, it's all about communication, it's all about listening. I think that the two guys that started City Beach, who are still very active in the business and really are driving it in a lot of ways with all of the products we stock, they listened. And I think that the spirit of listening has continued to this day. And they were probably early adopters of the idea that there is a way of personalizing most things. So and I love the story because I sat down when I first started and I sat with one of the two owners who back in the day was in charge of all marketing. And he said, well, we had this book on the counter. It's, you know, the black book, and you'd open it up whenever a customer came in, you write their name, their phone number, and you'd kind of make some notes about what they liked and their, you know, what they bought. So whenever a product came in that made sense for them, we'd call them up and say, you know, well, hey, Steve, like, there's this really great Billabong t-shirt that came in. You bought the black one last time. Would you be interested in the blue one? You'd see him walking past on the street and wave at him and say, hey, you know, yeah, like, you've got this new pair of jeans. And we'd invite him to parties and all that kind of stuff. And some people would show up and some people wouldn't, but we kind of grew this loyal fan base from this book. And I kind of think that spirit has remained. And I think that we've gone through some times where we were probably relying on our legacy a bit more than we should have. But I think now post GFC, which is crazy to think that was as long ago as it was, things are a little harder, right? That was 11 years ago that were thereabouts. You know, so things have gotten tough because people are savvy and the internet's here and there's a whole bunch of stuff. But I think if you look back and say, what was true then that is true now, and why have we remained, you know, where we are and still, you know, a growing business, it's because the DNA of those guys still remains. We listen, you know, and sometimes we listen better than other times, and, you know, we make mistakes and everybody does. But I think we listen to what the market is demanding and we're not shy about moving into it. So one of the interesting things that we've moved into is, you know, we've stopped stocking a lot of surf hardware. We realized that the market just wasn't interested in us as a retailer selling some of that stuff. There were specialists that did it better, but they were very interested in a lot of the brands that we sold. But then as the brand started to morph, you see that a lot of the skate brands, the core skate brands, have morphed into what we would call street brands. So you see, you know, Tyler, the creator, going up and accepting an award in the MTV Awards, and he has a Supreme hat on. Now I don't know a lot about Tyler, and probably a lot of people don't, but I know that Supreme is a skate brand. I don't know how close to skate he is, but it was kind of a pivotal point for a lot of brands where that kind of doesn't matter anymore. It's whatever the consumer has made of it. And so we've kind of followed the trends as a fast fashion retailer should. And I think that has lent itself to us being fresh. And then we just have continued in the spirit where we have a giant AI-driven smart book that tells you about the things that you've looked at and the things that are coming in might be relevant. And we're trying our best to stay on top of that technology so that we can kind of embody that same spirit in modern communication.
There was something I just wanted to go back to there when you say about you listen to the marketplace. And you know, I think this is something that, you know, all brands should be doing, and all brands doing it, you know, some better than others. When you say you listen to the marketplace, what does that really mean? Are you going out and having conversations with your target market? How do you get those learnings and understandings about what's happening in that demographic?
Well, we have the benefit of stocking a lot of brands that are happy to be very bold. So we have, you know, in excess of 300 different brands. Each one of them has, you know, their parts of the business that are kind of their staples, and they generally branch out into new territory. So we probably have one of the bigger SKU counts, or, you know, we have the one of the widest product ranges for those not in fashion retail, of most online retailers in Australia and in arguably in a lot of places, which is obviously quite cumbersome, but it also reveals a lot in terms of data. So we had the luxury of being able to stock some of the things that maybe sit on the kind of outside of your normal product range. And then if it works, we're able to have conversations with those brands to indicate that they have and kind of continue to stock them. So I think we're a very conversion-focused organization. And because of that, we're able to pinpoint quite quickly what's working, what's not from a product range perspective. And then it's not too hard to extrapolate out. If the, you know, the purple graphic tee is working, then we should also stock the black, the green, and the red one. So we're data driven in that regard. And I think that, you know, we benefit greatly, as I said, from a bunch of brands that we stock that are happy to be bold. And we're able to leverage that and just kind of observe. So we're not having a lot of formal conversations with our customers, but they speak with their wallets and we're happy to listen.
I mean, I've said to, you know, some clients that they should actually sit down and speak kind of one-to-one with clients. But obviously, you guys have got a lot of data in there. And I guess that sort of leads me to that next question is how big a role is data playing to you guys within the organization?
Data in the last, probably, well, since I started, has become more and more a feature of everyday conversation. So there's always been kind of your dashboard reporting, but we've evolved that quite a bit as we've implemented newer and more modern systems that reveal that data more in a more consumable way. And I think the linchpin for us, certainly probably sprayed all over the internet for, you know, advocating for the Amarsys platform. So I'm certainly not shy about talking about that as a success for us. And I think that was a catalyst for us really kind of transforming the conversations internally about what the customer is doing from a communications perspective. We've always been data driven from the product perspective. The two owners are in our back of house system every day, observing what's moving, what stores and what products they should be buying, what products they should be pricing differently. So we've got an incredible group of people that are dealing with the product. And over the last 4 years or so that I've been on, we've tried to reach that same standard from a communications perspective and a customer data perspective. The journey's not over, and I don't think that anyone would claim that they're perfect. But we've come a long way in terms of understanding who our customers are and then trying to cater for them from a, you know, a cadence perspective and from a content perspective. But to wrap back to your question, we are a very data-driven organization, which is a blessing and a curse, because it's easy to hide behind percentages and some data. And oftentimes it's the information that you're not collecting that's not revealed, that's more telling than the things that you have right in front of you. Mm. So it's been a journey, and I think I'm very logical and analytical. So I enjoy those conversations. And now that we've got data flowing through in a more natural way, it's easier for me as a less technical person than most to be able to understand what's actually going on and ask those questions and without, you know, days and days of trolling through pivot tables, find some answers. Yeah. So it's an exciting time. And I think AI, kind of back to the taboo topic that we will talk about another day. I think the benefit of AI is that if you layer on smart intelligent services, you know, on top of data and the data is clean, then you should start to see some cross sections. And the smarter the AI becomes, or the longer the algorithm is allowed to run, the more interesting cross sections of data you'll find. So I'm excited about the next, you know, 12 to 18 months in terms of where those kind of products are going, what kind of data we'll be able to mine, or what kind of things will be nominated to us by computers to say, hey, looks like you've dropped 3% on the sell through of this kind of product, or the velocity on this other thing is dropped. Is there something else going on? And that'll ask the questions, and maybe we'll find some interesting answers.
What sort of numbers do you look at? You obviously have access to a lot of data, but as a retail business or as a head of marketing, what kind of numbers do you sit there and check all the time?
Well, there's the obvious ones, and if you're not looking at your daily revenue, probably pretty crazy. We're obviously looking at, you know, top line revenue, so gross and net. And then we're always keeping an eye on our returns. So it's a bit of a, you know, an ongoing fun topic to understand what the consumers are doing in terms of, are they ordering a lot of stuff online, trying it on and sending it back? Or, you know, how is that dynamic working for us? So it's an interesting one to keep an eye on. Obviously, items per sale, average order value. And there's a whole bunch of other data around the communication stack. So, if you know, how many emails are we sending? What kind of unsubscribe rates are we getting? Click-through rates and all that kind of stuff. So we're not looking at anything particularly special there. The interesting, our shift in technology has revealed some rather obvious metrics to measure, but that were typically hard to find. So average order value is easy, but then your lifetime value sometimes is a bit muddy. So those kind of things are interesting because they push some value back into the conversations that happen early on. And oftentimes the attribution is really kind of last click stuff, as opposed to looking at, how we acquiring customers and which customers from which channels are more valuable than others and all that kind of stuff. So those are the kind of conversations that we're having, probably not every day, but certainly on an ad hoc basis, that are delivering a lot of value back into the organization.
Well, whilst we're on that subject then, the nerdy marketing bit, the technology that you guys are using, what are some of the platforms that you use for, you know, emails, for, you know, what's the website built in? I mean, you know, we deal with a lot of e-commerce retailers. There's, there's small e-commerce retailers, there's bigger e-commerce retailers out there. I'm just interested to see, you know, obviously you guys are a big organization and obviously have a robust online presence, but what sort of technology drives all these, everything that you do in the back end?
So our kind of, as I mentioned earlier, Marsis has become really part of our holistic communication stack in terms of communicating.
Can you spell that for us? Yeah. Just so Marsis.
As soon as you asked me, I realized I can't spell. I'll just bring it up. So it is EMARSYS. And it's emarsis.com.
EMARSYS. Okay. Yeah. Emarsis.com. All right, cool.
So, and just a bit of background, they're not particularly big in Asia Pac yet. They're relatively, they're significant in Europe and kind of trying to break into the US market. So they've put some heavy investments in there as far as I understand. But so we moved off of Salesforce into Emarsis, and I have to say that, like, it was off the back of internally, my team is an incredible team. So they put a lot of effort into making sure that worked really well. And the transition from platform to platform went smoothly, but you know, it's not without its hiccups, but the integration went amazingly well. And I think as a result of that, we're kind of in a really privileged position to be, you know, one of their key clients within the Asia Pac region and kind of invited to weigh in on some stuff that they're doing. So we're heavily involved with Emarsis as a communication stack. So we send our emails and SMSs out by them. They also kind of house a lot of our key customer data because we just don't really have any other systems to provide that information to us. So it's been an exciting journey to work with them on what was like a like for like swap out. And then what we've done is continue to work with them on a whole bunch of other things that they're releasing into the market. So we'll soon have a CDP deployed with them. So it's a customer data platform. So it's like a CRM on steroids with AI running on top. And then we've also kind of we're working with them on a whole bunch of other things that they're looking to deploy into the market around retail. So can't go into too much detail because I don't know they're actually sharing with the rest of the market, but there's a whole bunch of other tools that they're going to be deploying, and we're kind of working behind the scenes to help them refine that. Because I think Asia Pac and Australia specifically is a bit of a different beast. And we have to work a little harder here than I think our North American brethren do, because the population size is so much smaller. You just can't get away with being lazy. And then your question. So Emarsis is sort of servicing us on a whole bunch of different dimensions, from a communications perspective. And then our current website's built on WebSphere.
Okay.
That's an IBM product, which is at end of life from what I understand. So IBM sold that off to a new party. And so we're obviously, as part of that, kind of going to be transitioning off of the platform. But again, we haven't kind of formalized that conversation yet with our nominated future vendor, but maybe a future podcast will, I'll be able to talk deep and meaningful about our new website and all of the fun things that we're going to do there.
What's your thought from a platform? I mean, you've obviously seen a lot of backend, you know, platforms, and you know, what systems have you used that you would admire? Maybe admire is probably the wrong word when you talk about web driven systems, but you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think rather than a system specifically, I think the ethos behind them has changed. You're not getting a CD in the mail anymore, popping into your computer and loading up your new website. Like, it just doesn't work like that anymore. So I think SaaS is the future, and I've kind of worked in that space just, you know, briefly. But I think that the reality of the way all technology is moving, it's kind of what I like to consider the democratization of all of this kind of stuff. So the reality is that up until now, we've had, you know, large teams with huge infrastructure to support. And we're moving to kind of the iPhone model, where the iOS in the background is updating behind the scenes, and it really shouldn't affect any of your apps. And you don't really need to think about it anymore. So I fully embrace that model, where we don't have, you know, four or five people worrying about the servers and the CDN and all this other kind of stuff. It's like, well, that's the functional component of this conversation. And, you know, quite frankly, it's best left to a few people that will do the best in making sure that that's all functioning. And also the economies of scale you get from having 1,000 big clients on a stack that you can kind of move around means that they can get it for cheaper and maintain it more effectively. So I think everything's moving to that model, and, you know, anyone holding on to the dream that they'll sell you a piece of software, you know, in 5 years' time, you might come back and buy another CD, is probably fairly delusional at this point. I don't think there's too many people like that left, but
yeah.
So I think web platforms are going that way. You'll end up with, you know, a nice nimble platform that allows you to layer a whole bunch of customizations on top.
When moving from the technical side of things to the channels that you guys operate in, you mentioned emails there as you know, that you send out promotional emails. A couple of questions here. Number one, how important is email as a communication tool for you to your demographic? Again, bear in mind we're talking a younger demographic, and people often don't necessarily associate that younger demographic with opening emails. How important is that platform, emails? And the second question is, what other platforms work for you, you know, around, and I imagine there's social media, but other things that you use to communicate with those end users?
So the most effective communication tools are generally the ones you don't have to pay a lot for, because the ROI is relatively easy to map. So I think, you know, obviously conversion tools really are kind of our stores and our online platform. And, you know, obviously there's a whole bunch of layers that go into properly converting people in store, you know, staff and product and all that kind of stuff. And then online, there's a whole bunch of steps that need to walk through. So to lure them in, which is probably really more of the questions, is email relevant to our audience? It is. It's an effective platform if you don't abuse it. And, you know, we have been known to abuse it in the past, and we're reformed. We apologize. We went to the meetings. So, you know, we're
email,
moving away
email
from,
is, yeah. Email is anonymous. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, batch and blast anonymous. Exactly. Yeah. Right.
So we've all been there. We've all done it.
It's too tempting. It's like, you know, it's
surely,
something that
surely they won't mind five emails in one day. You know, let's just send them and see what happens. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a few people that don't, you know, and unfortunately that kind of validates the whole argument. But I think reality is that used effectively, email is still highly relevant. And I think there's an awful lot of a lot of things that we're doing in terms of the personalization of those communications that mean that it's still relevant. It's a super cost-effective way of communicating. So acquiring a customer and, you know, getting their details and then putting it on to, you know, forming up some view of what they like to buy and then sending that to them still works quite well. And I think in terms of layering on top of that, obviously, you know, the old adage of show them the ad 3 times and they'll convert just doesn't apply anymore with the way that modern people work, you know, travel through life.
Yeah.
So you sort of need to be on all channels and communicating based on the preferences of the individual. So again, working with Amarsys, we've deployed a whole bunch of different programs into our platform that allow us to drive retention and conversion strategies based on one-to-one communication. So regardless of kind of where you pop up, if we can identify you, we can serve you with something relevant. Now, that, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. So it's a matter of making sure that we're not getting too carried away, but we're able to serve comms across email, SMS, into your social feeds, you know, while you're searching. And then, you know, ideally in the future, we're able to identify more of the people that are walking into store and be able to customize the communications that they're receiving in store as well. So we've already digitized our signage in store and it's all linked back through a company called Mandoi, who Telstra took a liking to and dumped a bunch of cash into. So they're fairly well funded for the next little while. And so we've deployed, you know, I remember at the last count, about 400 large format digital screens that are all linked in to a network and, you know, powered by a head office. So we're able to schedule and communicate through those quite effectively. So I can see a possible future, you know, which is probably not too distant, where we'd be able to, you know, identify people as they come through and possibly cater for what they're searching for using the in-store signage as well. So I think the younger generation, I think that everyone's the same, and it's probably a bit of a controversial way of approaching it, but people are people. So young people, old people, they just want to have natural communication. And I think the channel that they pop up in the most is the one that they probably prefer to hear from you in, if it's appropriate. So I'm kind of reluctant to abuse SMS, because I think that for a lot of people is kind of like your private communication channel. Yeah. You know, you hand your mobile phone out to your friends. You don't necessarily hand it over to a brand to advertise to you. So email's nice because it's discreet and it doesn't typically interrupt your, you've decided to opt into communications from that channel, but also you've further opted in mentally into checking your email. Whereas an SMS can interrupt what you're doing. You know, I'm out for dinner and all of a sudden get an SMS from a brand saying that their, you know, mattresses are 50% off. It's like, well, great. I'm eating dinner now. not appropriate. So I think there's a lot of layers. We use a whole bunch of different things. Probably, surprisingly, social media is probably not as effective as most people would assume for a youth fashion retailer. And I think a lot of the success that people speak about in social is coming from pure play online retailers that leverage a lot of celebrity and a lot of influencer marketing to kind of power their brand. And strangely enough, I think that the physical stores that we have are probably our best communication asset, because they're, you know, in your face, there's product in there. You can go and touch and feel. We've got staff that are young and engaged and excited about being there and happy to chat. So I think all those things kind of layered together mean that I've got a pretty powerful tool that a lot of people don't. And I think, you know, social is great and it kind of plays a part in a broader conversation with those guys, but it's probably not the be all and end all.
I mean, you're closing on 500,000 followers on Instagram. There's I mean, the stuff that you've got on Instagram is obviously fairly predictable in terms of brand shots and models and all those kind of things. Just as a complete side, the little comments that you're putting on Instagram are actually quite funny. Who's writing those? Is that an internal thing or is that an agency thing?
Yeah, no, that's all our we've got a team of three up in the right. Social team that are kind of finger on the pulse of whatever's going on. So they cobble together a whole bunch of different things and pop them up there. And if they work, then they continue down that journey with our audience. So we have some quotes and a whole bunch of that kind of stuff. And then you're kind of more obvious product shots with models and whatnot.
Yeah. All right. Well, look, I mean, I'm going to sort of get onto my final questions because otherwise we're going to be here all day. I'm interested. You're exposed, obviously, in your business to a lot of brands, and you have been exposed to a lot of brands. Outside of the ones that you see every day, what are some of the brands that you admire yourself that you think are, you know, kicking goals or doing a fantastic job?
Well, in terms of fashion brands,
I mean, I'm interested in any brands.
In any brand. Yeah, for sure. I mean, the ones that are closest to home are fashion, which is obvious for so, like, I think someone like Supreme, which I mentioned earlier, is a brand that has done something that a lot of people just can't figure out. And I think it's an interesting journey to look at and understand. I think from my perspective, it's kind of this anomaly that gets held up in a lot of conferences, and the guys related to the brand are pretty shy about really speaking to anybody about what they're doing, which I think kind of adds to the mystery of it all. And I think that to me is exciting. And then I've had the privilege of chatting with a few guys from Gymshark, which isn't a huge brand in Australia for a lot of people, but it's enormous. It's just like hundreds and hundreds of millions of pounds a year of athleisure and athletic wear going out of their doors. And they're a pure play that have done some interesting things with physical locations and just continue to impress. And it's, you know, a young guy that basically started in, I remember what town in the UK. And, you know, he's got pictures of him driving to the post office with his first set of orders and how excited is he to this enormous company. So I think those kind of success stories are kind of fun to observe. And then kind of more outside of fashion, you know, I can't but help but watch the Tesla spectacle unfold in front of me. that's super interesting in kind of an interesting story to follow because it's sort of this megalomaniac, you know, guy that's kind of, it's just like the story writes itself. And the only other thing that's interesting to me, and it's kind of probably a little bit controversial, is that as a Canadian, I've kind of seen the rise of legalization of marijuana in Canada. So it's a whole industry now, and it's a very, very lucrative one. And what you say about the lifestyle, you know, kind of is secondary to the fact that from a marketing and a communications and in a kind of retail perspective, it's just amazing. Like the revenue generated from that kind of stuff has, you know, eclipsed. I mean, the tax revenue from it for a lot of the local governments has been, you know, it's addictive. So I think that that's a really interesting space. There's a company called Lyft & Co. that is kind of a content hub for that industry, and I've taken note of those guys. I think there's a lot of interesting things that are going to come from that space that are going to impact a lot of other organizations as they start to roll out, because it's not something that's really, from an industry perspective, it's not really detracting from something else. You know, maybe Coca-Cola is going to argue that no one's drinking their product anymore because they're all off smoking weed, but I kind of argue that actually the people that you probably expect to possibly suffer from this might gain the most. So it's an interesting addition to a lot of markets. And, you know, I don't know if it's ever going to be something, a feature of the domestic market here in Australia, but from afar, it's interesting to watch because it's a complementary thing for a lot of organizations. It's an obscene amount of money that they're talking about. So it's just a curious thing, the curiosity in a different way to Tesla. But ironically, those stories have intersected at least once, which is kind of a funny anecdote as well. So I think that's interesting for me, just kind of understanding what's going on. And then I'm personally into like fitness and all that kind of stuff. So I think the wearable technology is an interesting thing, and it kind of intersects in a lot of ways with AI and personal information and security and all sorts of other things. So I think there's a whole bunch of dimensions around AI and whether someone's going to develop something that is a personal AI that protects your information as the advent of wearables and, you know, sharing all this, you know, personal information gets into the hands of computers and those computers start to try and figure you out. Are you going to have some layer that protects you from all of that? You know, like all those kind of big questions are kind of what keeps me up up is probably keeps me up and excited, I guess.
Okay, last couple of questions. In terms of where you learn from, books, people, websites, how do you keep yourself educated about business, marketing, those kind of things? Where do you digest information from?
The one and only Paper Planes podcast is the
yeah, that's a terrible,
my only source of information.
People can tell you're lying that far off, Mike. Yeah. That's good.
Well, but strangely enough, it's not too far from the truth. So I live on the Gold Coast and commute up to Brisbane every day. Okay. So it's about an hour and a half in the car each way. And so, a lot of people would say I'm crazy, but it's actually a really valuable opportunity for me to do some self-development. So I listen to endless podcasts. I'm a big fan of audiobooks. So
yeah,
I certainly have not been shy in smashing my Audible account with all sorts of crazy titles. But there's a few authors that I've always kind of turned to. So Malcolm Gladwell, a fellow Canadian, is one that I will read everything he publishes.
Yeah.
There's a whole bunch of different amazing authors that have published a bunch of stuff. And admittedly, some things you might take one or two ideas from, kind of move on. And I think the concept of, not shying away from, interacting with things that you may not be comfortable with, or diving into a territory that isn't what I consider safe space is interesting. So certainly haven't been shy with the old audiobooks. So that's kind of where I spend most of my time.
I think I said this in a couple of podcasts ago about audiobooks and about how audiobooks allow me to actually read things that I would never normally have picked up and actually read, if that makes sense, because, often they're quite challenging. And I'm reading, I've forgotten even what I'm reading now at the moment on Audible. And I do the same. I smash the Audible account as well. I'm reading The Hero with 1,000 Faces, Joseph Campbell, and to be honest with you, I would have never picked that book up ever. And it's a heavy book. It's an intellectual book, of which I am not intellectual, but, I love audiobooks. I think they're, something I've discovered in the last couple of years, but,
To your point, I think there's a bunch of books that would look intimidating on a shelf. And interestingly enough, one of the search, tactics I've got, because I've got so much time in the car, is that I sort them by longest to shortest, because it strangely enough, I'm not sadomasochistic, but if I've got a 3-hour daily commute and I buy an audiobook for $14 and I get through it in a day, I don't see the value. And so it's a really messed up way of picking things to listen to, but if there's two or three books that I'm looking at and one's 6 hours long and the other one's 26 hours long, then, I might pick the 26 hour one first, because, either they go into a lot of territory that the 6 hour one can't. But I can always end at 6 hours and say, well, this isn't really interesting. But the advent of audiobooks in the podcasting revolution, which you are a part of, kind of plays into that whole voice search thing, strangely enough, because there's an aspect of convenience that comes to having your hands free and your eyes free and your mind engaged, because, you're able to do whatever you're doing without a lot of extra input. So, if you're driving, or if you're doing some sort of menial task, or you're able to perform something by rote, and you're able to listen with your ears and kind of expand your brain. Well, I mean, why wouldn't you do that? And I think the voice search is kind of a weird dimension to that, where you're able to kind of almost outsource some of that to a device, much like you're able to kind of engage your brain in a completely other end of the spectrum while you're doing something with your hands that may not be as demanding on your presence, or your mental presence anyway.
When you drive home today, what are you listening to?
I've been listening to Extreme Ownership by Jacko Willick and Leif Babin, who are two ex-Navy SEALs. And that's just because they're kind of in a bunch of different spaces. But this is kind of their book, and it's some sort of bestseller. Very exciting. And I didn't pick that one necessarily because it was particularly long. But I was recommended it a few times because I kind of feel like a lot of my management style kind of fits into that extreme ownership. I'm the first to apologize and take the bullet for the team.
Yeah.
And then try and make sure that that mistake is never made again, or, you know, how can we learn from this and how do I listen actively for what's going on and try and have some situational awareness and, you know, triage and all those kind of fun things. So yeah, that's a super engaging book. It's probably going to end before I feel satisfied with with the topics. I'll have to find something else, but yeah, that's the one that's interesting. Kept me engaged for a little while.
I'm just trying to think of, there was one that I was going to recommend to you that I now can't find. The Culture Code. I don't know whether you've read that one. Daniel Coyle, Coyle.
Yeah.
He talks about it's the secrets of highly successful groups. So anyone out there, I absolutely recommend that one if you're building or running a team. He looks at, you know, successful teams around the world, and he talks about the Navy SEALs, the New Zealand All Blacks. You know, how those great teams are built and run and things like that. So,
Sure. Well, and it sounds perfect. Yeah. I'll grab that.
Yeah.
And there's one, there's a few by Malcolm Gladwell that sound a little bit similar, obviously different in terms of not being team specific. But Outliers is an interesting one where Malcolm Gladwell kind of unpicks this idea that people have natural and inherent talents and goes through a whole bunch of different things on that. It's just super, super interesting. So if I can recommend one back to you.
Cool. Thank you.
That would be it.
I think I've read Outliers, but that I probably would have read it.
You'd be in a minority if you haven't.
Yeah. I think it was one of those ones that I've read, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, and it's probably worth sitting down and reading again because I think it's one of those books that.
Yeah, for sure. Listening to it, nothing else. Yeah. He's the narrator of it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's just super entertaining.
Look, thank you very much. I was going to say we could probably do another 45 minutes here on book reviews, but and then another 45 minutes on AI. But we'll save all that for another time. So look, I just thank you for your time on the show today. Last question I have for you: if anybody wants to get hold of you, what's the best way of reaching out and saying hello?
I'm a recovering LinkedIn addict, so I'm on there and I'm happy to accept as many. I've coined myself as a LinkedIn influencer at this point because I just happily accept anybody. So I'm all over LinkedIn, and that's probably from a professional perspective the easiest way of tracking me down.
I've just requested you on there as well. So there we go.
Let's listen. Strangely enough, I'm already on here. So I'm on there. I think I'm not sure how you find me, but I've got a lovely black and white photo on there, which was taken at some sort of conference. But hit me up on LinkedIn. I'm happy to have a chat. And you've got some super good ideas, you know, shoot them through.
Awesome.
Or book recommendations, probably better yet.
Yeah, hopefully you might get 100 book recommendations now.
Exactly. Well, I've got lots of hours to burn off in the car. So
I'll email you some later. I've got a couple of others as well. So.
Please do.
Thank you very much for your time today. It's been great. It's some fantastic insights into what you're doing. So really appreciate your time.
No, and I appreciate what you're doing here. I think all of the podcasts that I've listened to date have explored interesting territory and spoken to some really engaging people. So I think I've certainly learned, disingenuous. I've learned a whole bunch of stuff from what you've been able to pull together, and it's not an easy task. So, you know, kudos to you for pulling this together and, you know, keep it up.
Awesome. Really appreciate that. Thank you again, mate.
Not at all.
That's pretty much it from us from episode number 66. We appreciate that you have tuned in again. If this was your first time listening to the show, thank you very much for tuning in. If you have been here before, then thank you for returning again, and we appreciate it. One last reminder about those ratings and reviews on iTunes. We would like to try and get that up to 20, so please go in there and do that for us. We'd love you for it. We'll give you a big hug. So thank you. See you next week.